When we lived on the land and grew our own food from seed, there were many seed companies selling many different varieties of seeds. But now that we live in the city and get our food off the shelves of supermarkets, there are few seed companies selling ever fewer varieties of seeds. This consolidation of the gene pool leads us to ask, why save the many when just a few might do?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 671st edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Milan who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Howdy.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones.
Hello there.
Folks, when we lived on the land, our crops became acclimated to the climate of the neighborhoods in which we lived. Every year, we would save seeds from our best crops to sow for next year's crops. In making this selection, year after year and decade after decade, we developed in our crops the genetic intelligence required to produce the most food for the least effort. Every little climate had its own variety and strain of seeds, and consequently, there were many seed companies selling many different varieties of seeds. Then we moved into town. Now we get our food from the shelves of a supermarket. This supermarket food, more likely than not, comes from the fields of a giant farm over 1,000 miles away. This industrial farm produces a tremendous volume of one crop and does not need to have a variety of seeds. Consequently, there are fewer and fewer seed companies selling fewer and fewer varieties of seeds. This consolidation of the food chain and the genetics thereof leads us to ask, why save the many when just a few might do? Here to help us dig for an answer on this tough question today, we have John Torgrimson, who is the editor of Seed Savers Exchange. John, welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning, Michael.
Pleasure to have you aboard. Tell us a little bit about the Seed Saver Exchange.
Well, Seed Savers is located near Decorah, Iowa. And we're actually in our 35th year, 2010. The organization was started in 1975 by Diane Ott Wheely and her husband, Kent. They were handed down some two varieties of seeds from Diane's grandfather, who received them from his father, who had immigrated to America in the late 1800s from Germany.
Wow.
Those two seeds kind of got Diane and Ken thinking, well, are there other people in America who have this a similar responsibility of trying to preserve seeds that have been handed down from generation to generation?
Sure, and when you talk about a responsibility, you know, your grandparents give you seeds that their grandparents gave them and said, here, save these seeds, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Uh-oh.
And they took an ad out in Mother Earth News and attracted about 20 people that were doing similar things.
Mm-hmm.
They managed to get together one summer for a seed exchange and to share kind of ideas, and the whole notion of Seed Savers was born in 1975, and at that time, the Wheelies were living in Missouri.
Good, and so we have a Seed Savers Exchange now. It's 35 years old and alive and cooking.
Yeah, it's those two seeds we now have in our collection, over 25,000 seeds and plants that have been handed down from
grandparents to grandchildren, right?
People like the Wheelies,
right.
You know, that and a lot of that comes from just amateur gardeners throughout the world who have received similar kinds of
sure.
varieties of vegetables and what have you, flowers, herbs from their predecessors.
Well, we always ask who pays your way. So, who pays the way for the Seed Savers Exchange?
Well, we are a nonprofit organization. Mm-hmm. There's two aspects to our operation. One is the collection side, where we actually maintain the collection, and part of our mission is also to make sure that we distribute these seeds. So it's not just we're hoarding these things in Iowa. We also want other people, including seed companies, to offer these varieties. We do have a seed catalog that where we do offer about 600 varieties of different seeds to the public. We send that catalog out to about 200,000 people annually.
So you make a little money selling seeds, and you get some donations here and there, and that's how you get by.
Yeah, we are a membership organization with nearly 11,000 members, so memberships and seed sales is what allows us to continue.
Well, we look forward to getting into the Seed Savers Exchange as we go through the program. Also with us today, Rich Ocheck, who is with Horizon Herbs up in Southern Oregon, little town of Williams, up there in the great state of Jefferson. Rachel, thank you for joining us today from Horizon Seeds.
Hello, Michael. Hi, John.
Hi.
Good to have you aboard Horizon Herbs. What, tell us a little bit about your organization, your company.
Well, yes, we're a small family certified organic seed grower farm and a state certified nursery. We specialize in production of medicinal herb seed, and we've been in business since 1985, so this is our 25th year, and we're looking forward to collecting more and more different varieties of medicinal herb seeds from all over the world and disseminating them out to our customers. We are a private concern. We have a very popular seed catalog that we issue twice a year, and we work with about 1,000 species.
Wow.
We are also a very diverse operation, but just on 5 acres here in the Siskiyou Mountains of Southern Oregon.
Mm-hmm. A beautiful neck of the woods, too, down there by in the Applegate Valley. Well, when we ask who pays your way at the Horizon Herbs, I guess you would say paying customers.
Yes. A lot comes in from our various publications.
Mm-hmm.
That we have 3 very popular books that we've written, and then we also have a staff of about 12 local people who work for us and who garden and farm here and work in our seed house and in the seed room and disseminate the seeds out to the public. So my wife holds the purse strings, and I write the books.
All right, good for you. Well, let's start it off here. How do hybridize, or how do heritage seeds, or heirloom seeds, is there a difference between heritage and heirloom?
Well, I think people refer to them in the same way. I mean, heirloom is an heirloom seed is something that's been handed down mm-hmm. within a family. Think of it as heirloom jewelry, you know, and I got grandma's, you know, earrings or whatever, or china. In some ways, that's the same thing with heirloom seeds. They've been handed down, usually within a family. We like to say that every variety of seed has a story to tell, that it's come from somewhere and it's been somewhere. So on that note, you know, it's kind of relates to a family or in some cases, just person-to-person being exchanged.
Mm-hmm. So with respect to what's the difference then between heirloom seeds and modern seeds?
Well, heirloom seeds, basically, when they're planted out, they are going to stay true to the parent that it came from. So if I'm saving a Brandywine tomato this year and I plant it out next year, it's going to give me a Brandywine tomato.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of modern seeds today are hybrids, if you will, are created for a specific purpose. During our tomato tasting event this past Labor Day weekend, where we had about 1,000 people to show up to sample 40 different heirloom varieties of tomatoes, one man asked in one of our workshops, how come grocery store tomatoes taste like red rubber balls? And and that's not to say that every tomato in a grocery store tastes that way.
Well, I wouldn't agree with that. I think some taste like tennis balls.
Okay, well, there you go, Michael. But, you know, essentially sometimes that particular hybrid might have been created for a specific purpose.
Well, let me go back to this notion of hybridization with respect to not staying true. So when you make a hybrid, you take 2 different varieties, right?
Two or more different varieties, right. and you're mixing traits from each of those.
Okay, and then in the first generation of that cross, you get an interesting hybrid.
Correct.
And then in other generations, in further generations, you don't know what you get, right?
Well, that first generation, let's say you take that seed and you plant it out, you're not sure which of the parents it's going to replicate.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have, let's say it comes from four different strains of tomato. And your goal is to create a tomato that looks good, has nice shapes, ships well, sits on the shelf a long time without spoiling, and also maybe has a relative type of flavor. Well, when you take that seed and you plant that out, you're not sure which of those is going to show up. Is it the long shipper? Is it the long shelf life? Is it the color, or is it the shape that's going to
okay,
be
we'll
predominant?
Okay, we're going to have to pick this one up when we come back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with John Torgrimson from the Seed Savers Exchange and Richo Check from Horizon Herbs in Southern Oregon. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
So why save the many when the few just might do? A lot easier to have a few seeds and a lot to choose from. So that's the question of the day. And do you save your seeds out there, or are you happy getting your food off the shelves of a supermarket? Here to discuss the issue with us today, we have John Torgrimson, who is the editor of Seed Savers Exchange, and Richo Check with Horizon Herbs up in Williams, Oregon. We were talking about the difference between hybridized seeds and heirloom seeds, and we learned that hybridized seeds have been cultivated or produced, propagated, I guess, for specific traits. So, Richo, I'd like to ask you, why not save hybridized seeds rather than heirloom seeds?
Well, I think that really comes down to the various differences that you find on the farms in the different ecoregions. Not everybody's weather is the same.
Right.
There's the external environment of how much sun you get and what the soil and what the rainfall is like and what the gardener does to nourish the land with cover crops and that sort of thing. And then there's sort of the internal environment, which is the nature of the soil and how that interacts with different kinds of varieties of plants, either the cultigens, which are the human-made selections that are mainly the vegetable varieties that have been saved over the generations and are still being produced really as new open-pollinated selections. We see a lot of new corn varieties coming out, for instance, which are cold tolerant or have a lot of phytonutrients in them, nutrates. We say, well, organically grown seeds do best in organic gardens.
Wow.
And so we find that, if we choose seeds to, do well in a set of circumstances which would be the kinds of circumstances that a small town-based gardener or someone on a small acreage that's really feeding their soil could use, then we find that those work a lot better than ones that are mass-produced for large-scale farmer with chemical applications on the land.
Good. John Torgerson, we talked a little bit about the difference between hybrid and heirloom seeds and how heirloom seeds kind of hold true from generation to generation. What about if hybrid seeds, if we save them from generation to generation, what happens?
Well, and I think that's a good point you're bringing up, Michael. It's not necessarily an either-or proposition. If you think of, like, tomatoes, they originated in South America,
mm-hmm.
and the Spanish took them back to Europe, and over time you had all this kind of cross-fertilization of varieties. When Grandpa Ott brought his German pink tomato from Dusseldorf, Germany, to Decorah, Iowa, it obviously was different than the original
right.
one that came from South America. But the genetics of that plant have stabilized, and over time you can reproduce that German pink, and it will be true to the original German pink.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily that hybrids are bad things. It's just that once their genetics are stabilized. A good example is the green zebra tomato, which was developed by a man by the name of Tom Wagner. And he brought together four different kinds of tomatoes to produce that green zebra strain. And now people would call that a modern heirloom in the sense that the green zebra was developed probably about 25 years ago. Now, if you save the seeds of that green zebra, you will get a green zebra. And you won't get a deviation of the four original strains that you
created. And, of course, that's what the problem is with respect to saving hybrid seeds, is that you don't really know what you're going to get, right?
Exactly.
Okay, good. That's what I wanted to get across. Now, let's go to the big question. We've since learned in the last couple decades how to manage traits of our seeds, which is to say we can reprogram the genetic structure of seeds to do things that they would otherwise not do. How has that affected the seed industry? John, let's start with you and then go to Richo.
Well, I think most seed companies operate on a profit motive, so they're looking mm-hmm. to put into the marketplace those kinds of varieties that gardeners have a demand for. In some cases, they're creating a new variety or a hybrid to try to target a certain part of their marketplace. At Seed Savers, our goals are a little bit different. We're interested in maintaining genetic diversity. And so in our collection, for example, we've got several thousand types of seeds and plant varieties. But our goal really is to get seed companies and gardeners to continue to use those so that that particular variety continues to be part of our entire genetic diversity. So I think another way of looking at it is someday, for example, we have nearly 6,000 different tomato varieties in our collection. And someday, maybe it will be important to use some of those traits, as Richard has indicated, that are specific to a climate or mm-hmm. a weather pattern or whatever circumstances might present themselves, say, 300 years from now.
So we don't know what the intelligence will be used for, but we just know that it's important to keep the intelligence around so that if we do need it, it's there.
Absolutely.
Okay, Richard, what about the folks who genetically engineer crops, and how have they changed the seed industry in the last 20 years?
Well, they've changed it a lot, and here we're trying to create some counter pressure on that whole movement, and really,
you guys are essentially the Davids taking on the Goliaths with respect to seeds, right?
Well, we're really not taking them on. We're just doing what we do, and
right,
trying to serve the public in that way, and I think people, hopefully people can choose what's going to work best for them, and hopefully, we won't be having genetically modified traits, showing up in our basal crops here.
Mm-hmm.
But we just operate on faith. And with medicinal herbs, it's really quite different from vegetables. I mean, to a large extent, you're looking for a return to the original form, what we call the native land races. And I could give an example of, for instance, marigolds, the Tagetes genus. We have been very interested in using marigolds in making salves. The English used to call them pot marigolds or calendula. It's a little different from calendula, but modern herbalists haven't been using marigolds so much in making these antiseptic and anti-inflammatory salves. So I was looking around for a marigold that's unchanged from the original form. And they're called African marigolds because they're from Africa. So in 2009, I went to Zanzibar and I searched local gardens, the what they call bustani, for open pollinated upright marigolds that were singles. And eventually in a place called Waite on the island of Pemba, I found several thousand individuals growing in a garden that completely met the my mind's eye projection of what an open pollinated, you know, unmodified marigold would look like. So
and let me guess, Eureka! I found it.
Yeah, I mean it was right. It was in a garden behind a little sugar cane press where they were selling fresh cane juice, and we got a bunch of neighborhood kids to go out and collect from every marigold and. So that we could get a broad genetic basis for reintroducing the original form of the plant.
And that's the medicinal form.
Yeah. And
okay, we're going to pick it up when we get back. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here today. We're talking about seeds. Should we go for diversity or should we go for uniformity? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Collecting and saving seeds. Why should we and how do we do it? Right back. Well, when we lived in the country, we grew our food from seed, and our seeds accumulated the genetic intelligence to grow and develop in our neighborhood, specifically to the climate and the weather conditions of each of our own little neighborhoods. And so we saved those seeds from our best crops to use for next year's crops, and we refined that intelligence through the years. But then we moved into town, and who cares, you know? We get our food from the shelves of a supermarket, and the supermarket gets that food from some farm, probably over 1,000 miles away, and they only use one kind of seed. So consequently, we've seen a great consolidation in our seed companies here in the United States. I think I read this morning we're down to 100 independent seed companies in the United States. Rich O'Check, does that sound reasonable? 100 companies left in the entire country?
It really doesn't sound reasonable, but I guess it could be true. Another concern is that a lot of those seed companies are offering seed that appears to be their own offering, but actually they're all buying it from the same individual. So sometimes the source comes down to just one farmer somewhere.
Like you.
Like me. I see that happen quite a few times with bulk seed that we ship out, where another entity will offer it as something unique that they have, and really they don't exactly have it, and I don't mind that they do that, but it does mean that if something happens to us, then they won't have it.
So you're kind of the last place. John Torgrimson from the Seed Savers Exchange, does that sound reasonable? We're down to 100 independently owned seed companies in the United States?
It's very possible. I mean, you look at, back in the early part of our history in America, you had a lot more seed companies that were locally focused. In fact, there was a seed company in Decorah, Iowa, back in the 1800s. Well, that doesn't exist anymore. So, yeah, there's been a tremendous amount of consolidation. And we're no longer an agricultural-driven nation like we were in the 1800s, where everyone's livelihood was kind of tied to agriculture and, seed stocks and things like that.
Right. Now we live on borrowed money, and who needs agriculture, right?
Well, it's a little bit like that, yeah.
Let me go back and talk a little bit about why we ended up in this great consolidation and how folks like you two are left holding us afloat here. Let's go back to 1980 and the Bayh-Dole Act of 1980, which granted a plant patent to organizations, which meant that they could then own the traits and seeds. Holy smokes, what did that mean for the seed industry? John, let's start with you.
Well, it does change the playing field considerably. I mean, on one level, you want to give credit to people who are developing and breeding new varieties and things like that. In this case, it allowed for the genetic engineering of plants so that each variety has a specific goal when it is planted. And that copyright stays with the owner rather than with the farmer. So it changed the dynamics considerably in that sense. Seed Savers, really, our goal is that we want to make our seeds available to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of our mission really is to make sure that our collection is safe and secure. That said, there's nothing to prevent any company out there to buy our seeds and to basically do what they want with them.
Mm-hmm. So they could buy your seeds and then inject a genetic trait into those seeds and then own that, right?
Hypothetically, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Richard Check, you're with Horizon Seed Company. How would that make you feel if somebody went and got the calendulas that you dug up off Zanzibar and stuck a gene in it and owned it?
Well, once they stuck a gene in it, then that would diminish its value, so I wouldn't be too worried about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because we believe in the value of the native land races, and we actually do have a policy of releasing all of our seeds to the public domain. So we welcome people to grow them, and if they grow well, for people to replicate them through saving their own seeds.
Right.
We call them seed saver friendly. They're all open pollinated. They're not hybridized. So it doesn't worry me very much. I think it just requires a change of a focus on the part of the consumer to really have faith in the old ways and the original forms, like the Seed Saver Exchange inventory. Those foods fed us and were our medicine from many years ago, and they can still feed us. They're still relevant to this day.
Okay, since 1980 in the Plant Patent Act, a very interesting thing is happening, and in that the seed industry is being taken over lock, stock, and barrel, not by seed companies, but by chemical companies, Monsanto, DuPont, Syngenta. Those three chemical companies now must own most of the seed companies. Why would chemical companies own the seed industry, John?
Because they sell chemicals. And they're creating varieties that are resistant to certain kinds of chemicals. So, for example, Roundup Ready Corn, it's a seed variety that when you apply Roundup, which is a herbicide, to the ground, it will not affect that particular plant, but it will have an effect on anything else, such as weeds that might grow around it.
So essentially, seeds become a way of selling chemicals.
Correct, exactly.
So in the ownership of these seeds, there are some interesting legal applications. I'm thinking of a Canadian canola farmer by the name of Percy Smizer, who's stuck in the snow of Bruno, Saskatchewan today, or he would have joined us. Percy woke up one day to find that Monsanto's Roundup Ready canola seed had invaded his farm. And so he scratched his head, and next thing he knew, Monsanto took him to court for the unauthorized use of the canola seed that Percy never planted. And yet this seed somehow blew onto his farm, and Percy found himself at the at the end of the road. And in fact, Monsanto said that your farm is now our farm because you used, even unwittingly, our seed. And this Canadian Supreme Court found in Monsanto's favor. So here we have a situation that's kind of gone totally bizarre. The chemical companies own the seed companies, and the seed companies now own the farms where their seeds are grown. And so it would seem like folks like you, which we're down to maybe 100 in the United States, are kind of what's left, or the hope. Otherwise, we're going to be owned by lock, stock, and barrel by chemical companies and their seeds. Am I wrong?
Well, it would be a frightening scenario if chemical companies owned basically our, you know, food source.
Hold that. We'll be right back. Michael Olson. Why save the many when a few just might do? Well, and that's where we're at. We used to have many seeds from many different varieties, many strains, each acclimated, as it were, to the neighborhood in which they were grown. And then we all moved into town, and life changed. Our lives changed. We stopped growing our own food. We started buying it in supermarkets. And those supermarkets got their food from some big industrial farm 1,000 miles away. And that farm only uses one kind of seed, so that kind of describes the loss of our genetic diversity. And yet we have here today a couple fellows who are really trying to hold on to the genetic intelligence, our gene pool. And in the face of an industry that is continuing to consolidate, we now have three companies, Monsanto, DuPont, and Syngenta, that own most of the corn, wheat, and soybeans. And we note that with interest that Monsanto has purchased the largest vegetable seed company in the world. And so the seeds and the genetic intelligence of those seeds are going into the property of these large corporations. And what impact will that have on our future? Rich Ocheck, Horizon Seeds, I guess you're holding the line here and keeping this genetic intelligence. And yet there's not much you can do about what goes on out there other than keep saving seeds and keep educating people about the value of holding on to this genetic intelligence, right?
Well, just about everybody has the opportunity to grow some plants, and sometimes it's just a window box, and other times it's a community garden, and other times they really have a plot of land to work with. And, you know, growing that diversity and eating a diverse diet really is, the naturopaths tell us that that's really the basis of good health. So I think really that's the answer to your question, to the conundrum. Grow many varieties when a few varieties will do well? A few varieties don't really do.
Might do well. I said, you know? Might do well.
Okay, well, anyways, they don't do well for your personal health. Spring is coming. The dandelions will be volunteering. As long as they're unsprayed, my recommendation is, you know, add those to your diet. You'll be healthier.
Okay, that's good. John?
Same. Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly with Richard. Just a point, too, to be made about the Monsantos, DuPonts, and Syngentas of the world. In August, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder and U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack announced that they were going to hold hearings regarding competition in agriculture, including seed trade. So it'll be interesting to see where that discussion and that debate goes. Part of it is due in part to the fact that Monsanto and DuPont and Syngenta are all fighting amongst themselves, mm-hmm. and taking each other to court.
That's good as long as one of them doesn't win.
the other point I would make is that the National Gardening Association estimated there were 7 million new gardeners last year. So I think, as Richard said, everyone has the right to go out and grow a garden. And a lot of these people are brand new. They perhaps were motivated by the recession and the economics mm-hmm. of things. But a lot of them also, they want to know where their food comes from now. They don't want to just rely on the supply chain giving them a tomato at the grocery store. They want to discover for themselves, this is what a real tomato tastes like. And I can control where that came from.
Amen to that. Let's go to the phones, folks. The phone numbers today on the food chain, 800-624-2665-831-479-1080. I think we have Ellie. Ellie, are you there?
Yes, I am here. I'm going to have to pull over so I don't get a ticket.
Don't get a ticket.
Yeah, I would like to bring up the perspective that I think that I believe is the farmer Percy.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a property rights issue, and I think he should have sued and won that Monsanto polluted his property.
Well, that was an interesting question, though, because Percy had in his possession Monsanto's property, which was the seeds. Even though those seeds invaded Percy's farm, Percy was in possession of them, and the Supreme Court of Canada found that he was guilty.
And I see those seeds as an environmental hazard, and I think they should be treated as such. And I think that Monsanto polluted his property with this unnatural and very, basically, it's a biohazard.
Well, thank you for the call, and thank you so much for pulling over and getting out of traffic today for the food chain, Ellie. We really appreciate it.
And I'd also like to mention I'm running for assembly, and one of the goals I have is banning genetically modified crops in the state of California.
Well, good for you. Thank you very much. Now, what do you think about the notion of just banning genetically modified crops? I'll ask Rico, what do you think?
Well, you know, I never really go for the governmental answer, and my suggestion to Percy would have been just go ahead and plow down the camelina and grow some sunflowers or some mustard instead of going to court. You know, do something proactive and grow a different oil crop. In fact, this camelina I'm really interested in these days. It's a mustard family plant that goes way back and is extremely easy to dry farm and produces edible oil that's also a biofuel. You know, he had so many different options. He just got stuck in that negativity.
That's Percy Smizer. You know, when he was a young man, he twice took on Mount Everest. But in his senior years, he took on the biggest mountain of all, and that was Monsanto Corporation. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll go to Joe, who has an interesting notion about cloning. This is the food chain. Michael Olson here. Today, we're talking about the consolidation of the seed world, the consolidation of our gene pool, and what you and I can do about it by working with people like Horizon Herbs up in Oregon and the Seed Savers Exchange in Iowa. Good people saving our seeds. Right back. We're back. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Rich Ocheck, Horizon Herbs, Southern Oregon, and the little town of Williams, and also John Torgrimson, the editor of the Seed Savers Exchange in Iowa. And we're going to go quickly to Joe, who has a comment about cloning. Joe, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi. One of the things that I do know is that a lot of plants, it's kind of like starting a spider plant, but the only difference is you have to use a little root cone.
Uh-huh.
And you cut clippings off at the vegetation state when they're just in vegetation, getting ready to start their growth. And you cut clippings off and you put it in root cone and you continue that one. And it's called cloning.
Sure. And theoretically, all you need is a cell to start a new plant.
Right.
Because the cell has all the genetic intelligence needed to start that new plant, right?
Right. And everybody's worried about this. Well, don't worry too much. People just need to learn how to clone.
Right. Thank you very much.
And what we do is we send that plant into a shock, and it'll produce seeds that aren't sterile.
Very good. Well, thank you for the call, Joe. Really appreciate it. Let's go back to our guest, Rich Ocheck from Horizon Herbs up in Southern Oregon, and also John Tormgridson, who is with the Seed Savers Exchange. It's not enough to save seeds. We must use them to save them. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
John?
Yes.
So it's not enough just to save them. We have to use them. And to use them, we're going to have to rely on the private sector, or the you and I, essentially, those millions of new gardeners out there. So how do we go about saving the genetic intelligence of our seeds? How do we save that? Because if we rely on the corporations, they're just going to be down to a few seeds that contain their chemical-resistant genes in them. So we're going to have to reach out and use these seeds. We're going to have to plant them. So how do we go about doing that? John, Seed Savers Exchange, how does it work?
Well, you know, first of all, the stockpiling of seeds is essential. You've got the USDA, you've got Seed Savers, you've got various organizations throughout the world who are dedicated to not just collecting but maintaining that genetic diversity. Basically, by making our seeds available through our catalogs and what have you, we have 600 and some varieties available through the catalog. And there's millions of gardeners in America. I mean, it's just a matter of making available to them the opportunity to pick and choose what kind of seeds that they want to grow out.
And maybe each one of us in the United States should pick an open-pollinated heirloom variety of seed and grow it out and become responsible for it. How's that for an idea?
Sounds great.
What do you think, Mitchell?
I like it, too. I'm glad that there are some repositories for our genetic stock out there, frozen at low temperature and what have you. But I really believe in living repositories. It makes a lot more sense to just bring it down home, reduce the food miles or herb miles, as it were, in my case, make it a living collection that you're eating at the same time, and that's just a lot more vibrant than something that's cold and frozen somewhere.
Richo, how do we get in touch with Horizon Herbs?
You just go to horizonherbs.com.
Good enough. John Torkelson, yep. How do we get in touch with Seed Savers Exchange?
Seedsavers.org.
And there it is. So, folks, here's the deal. Each one of us out there, all millions and millions of us, are responsible for selecting one heirloom variety of plant and growing them out and collecting the seeds and redistributing them and saving them. And that way, we'll have something to pass on to our grandchildren. Thank you so much for tuning in.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.